From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, filling in for Terry Gross. The Pope addressed church leaders gathered in Rome today, saying there was no place in the priesthood for those who would harm the young, and calling sex abuse by priests in the United States a sin and a crime. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the Pope's statements and other developments in Rome with journalist John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. Also, French film director Laurent Conté on why his films deal with a world of work. His latest is the critically acclaimed Time Out, about a man who loses his job but keeps it a secret from his family. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Israel today blocked the arrival of a UN mission to investigate alleged human rights abuses at the Jenin refugee camp. Israel says the mission violates an agreement with the UN because Jerusalem was not consulted on the delegation's members. Palestinians and independent international aid agencies say Israeli soldiers committed human rights abuses in their attack on the camp this month. Pope John Paul II said today there's no place in the Roman Catholic priesthood for those who would harm the young. He spoke to U.S. cardinals and bishops at a special two-day session at the Vatican on the allegations of sexual abuse by Catholic priests. Catholic Cardinal Francis George of Chicago is attending the session.
That's a pretty clear statement that encourages us to be very vigilant and indeed committed to making sure that children are not harmed, especially by those who are in the priesthood or religious life.
George said there was no discussion of the possible resignation of Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston. At the Microsoft trial in Washington, lawyers for nine states pressed Chairman Bill Gates on the impact of sanctions proposed against the company. NPR's Larry Abramson has the story.
Gates submitted 155 pages of written testimony. Now lawyers for the states are taking Gates through a line-by-line analysis of that document. Gates objected to a sanction that says Microsoft cannot take any action that would degrade the performance of software made by a rival. Gates said that would make it impossible for Microsoft to fix problems with Windows, since those fixes sometimes hurt outside programs. Gates was then shown some of his own emails in which he clearly threatened to retaliate against rival software makers. Gates had to admit the sanctions would prohibit that kind of retaliation. Microsoft lawyers are struggling to limit the scope of questions directed at Gates. They're concerned Gates may concede that Microsoft could actually live with some of these sanctions. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan joined the U.S. Treasury Department in opposing an increase in federal deposit insurance coverage. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
Greenspan echoed Undersecretary of Treasury Peter Fisher in telling the House Banking Committee that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation already provides adequate insurance coverage of the nation's bank deposits. The FDIC now insures up to $100,000 per account, a limit that was set in 1980. The previous deposit insurance ceiling was $40,000. Some in Congress say it's time to raise the amount of coverage, but Greenspan and Fisher warned that further lowering depositors' risk of loss would reduce market discipline on banks to control the risks they take in making loans and other investments and would tend to weaken banks' balance sheets. They also said they have heard no demands from bank customers for increased deposit insurance. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
The Dow was down 47 points. You're listening to NPR News. Police in Berlin are advising members of the city's Jewish community to avoid wearing skull caps after recent anti-Semitic attacks in the German capital. NPR's Guy Raz reports from Berlin.
A police spokesman said Jews should refrain from displaying their faith in a way that may draw attention. He insisted that it's only a suggestion, not a formal recommendation. According to a local media report, law enforcement officers in the German capital are also suggesting the city's Jews avoid carrying around Hebrew language periodicals or religious texts. In the past 3 weeks, there have been two minor attacks against Jewish residents in the city. Authorities here have attributed the scuffles to the conflict in the Middle East. Security around Jewish sites in Berlin has been tightened in the past month. Barricades and armored vehicles protect nearly all Jewish synagogues, schools, and restaurants in the capital. Berlin is home to about 10,000 Jews. Before the Nazi regime came to power in 1933, Berlin's Jewish population numbered more than 170,000. Guy Raz, NPR News, Berlin.
White House counselor Karen Hughes said today she's leaving Washington. Hughes says she's homesick and wants to go back to Texas. Her surprise announcement marks the first resignation from President Bush's staff. The president says he'll continue to seek her advice. White House aides say the Republican National Committee could pay her to advise President Bush from Texas. Federal authorities have rounded up 94 employees in a new crackdown on undocumented workers. They're being held on charges ranging from illegal immigration to lying about a criminal background. Officials say the arrests are continuing at Reagan National Airport, Dulles International Airport in Virginia, and at Baltimore-Washington International Airport in Maryland. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the James Irvine Foundation, supporting NPR's West Coast expansion, www.irvine.org, partners in building a better California.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. American cardinals are meeting in Rome to discuss the sex abuse scandals that have rocked the American Catholic Church. 12 of the 13 U.S. cardinals are in Rome, as well as two top officials of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Addressing the cardinals today, Pope John Paul II made his strongest statement yet on the sex abuse scandal. He said, "The abuse which has caused this crisis is by every standard wrong and rightly considered a crime by society. It is also an appalling sin in the eyes of God. To the victims and their families, wherever they may be, I express my profound sense of solidarity and concern." My guest today is John Allen, who is in Rome covering this historic meeting. John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He also writes a regular column called The Word from Rome. I spoke with him earlier today. Let's start with what's happening right now. You've been to a briefing. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is the American cardinals and the chief executive officers of the American Bishops' Conference are locked in a room with the most senior officials of the Curia. That's the Pope's bureaucracy in the Vatican. And they are desperately trying to hammer out an agreement on sort of certain core matters of how you handle accusations of sexual abuse against priests, because the subtext to today is what's going to happen in June in Dallas when the U.S. bishops meet. They're going to adopt some pretty tough, by all measures, some pretty tough new policies. And the fear here is that if the Vatican and the U.S. bishops are not on the same page, then the U.S. bishops in June could adopt these new policies to great acclaim and fanfare in the American media, and then they would come over to Rome and get rejected. And I think everyone on all sides recognizes that that would be a public relations Chernobyl. And so the effort here is to try to make sure that everyone is singing out of the same songbook ahead of that June meeting.
So I heard there has been already some kind of statement today.
Yeah, there were actually two things. That the Pope made an address to the cardinals and the Curia officials this morning, in which he once again confirmed how heartsick the scandals have made him, how determined the Church is to be sure that people are not put in positions again where they can be abused. But at the same token, he reaffirmed the sort of traditional Christian, the notion of Christian conversion, which seemed to suggest that although there need to be tough policies for priests when they're found guilty of wrongdoing, that the Church in some sense wants to leave open the possibility that they can be salvaged in some way. I know one American cardinal thought it was quite important that the Pope, in the course of his statement, used the word crime, referring to the sexual abuse crisis as a criminal problem. And of course, this is a hurdle the Church has struggled to get over. I mean, it has in the past treated this as a spiritual problem that could be dealt with behind closed doors, rather than as a legal problem that needed to involve the criminal justice system. And so I know some observers thought that was a step forward. The other thing we've had today is a briefing involving Bishop Wilton Gregory, who is the president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, and Cardinal Francis George, who is obviously one of the American cardinals and has a reputation for being probably the brainiest of the American cardinals. And these two guys came out and talked to us after the morning session of meetings, and I think what was especially striking about their remarks were the unusually, and I have to say, as someone who follows the Vatican day in and day out, I mean, the very unusually candid, open, and honest nature of their comments. Bishop Gregory was asked about the debate over homosexuality in the priesthood, and he admitted without flinching that there are certain seminaries in the United States that have an overwhelmingly gay population, and that sometimes heterosexual candidates actually feel uncomfortable. Now, this is something that if you've been following the Catholic scene for years, I mean, everyone knows, but it's sort of been taboo to say that in public. I mean, I know a priest, Father Donald Cousins, who wrote a book a few years ago called The Changing Face of the Priesthood, in which he said this very thing, and was sort of demonized in many quarters of the church for saying it. And now you have the president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference putting it on record. I think that's remarkable. And then Cardinal George acknowledging very frankly today that there is a very serious disagreement within the Vatican and between certain U.S. bishops in the Vatican over the proposal for a one-strike-and-you're-out policy. That is, that if a priest abuses anyone once, that ought to be it, and he should be removed from ministry and ultimately defrocked. Some people want that policy. Other people have problems with it. You know, how these things are going to get resolved, we don't know. But I think the remarkable thing is how honestly disagreement and the existence of these problems are being voiced today.
You were mentioning that there was a very amazing candor that you saw today. And one of the things that I think Americans sense is that the Vatican has a very different sense of media, public relations, time. You know, they're not on the internet all the time with us looking at every story. They seem very distant, and sometimes that comes across as almost seeming contemptuous. Is that a misperception?
Well, I think it can be. I mean, I think this is an institution. I mean, the motto around the Vatican is "We think in centuries." You know, which means that they're trying not to think exclusively or be have their reactions dictated exclusively by today's controversy, but think in a sort of unhurried and reflective way about what the long-term consequences of something might be. Now, that can make for great wisdom, because sometimes the smartest thing to do in a crisis is to wait and see how it develops. But on the other hand, it also makes them very slow to respond sometimes to things that really do need a sort of urgent response. And I think that's probably what's happened in this case. I think the Vatican was slow to realize the depth and gravity of the crisis in the American church. But I do think that they have come around by and large, and I would frankly read this week's summit as an indication of that. I mean, the Pope, if he had wanted to, could have called the American cardinals over quietly. They could have flown below radar, but they chose to do this in a sort of dramatic, high-profile, last-minute way, bringing all of the American press with them. And I think in part that was an attempt to communicate to the American church, we get it, we understand. When the Vatican looks at this crisis in the American church, what they see is one part genuine scandal, that is, the sexual abuse of minors, of course, everyone in the Vatican regards as indefensible. And frankly, I have not met any senior Vatican official that in a quiet moment wouldn't acknowledge that certain American bishops, for example, Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston, have made serious mistakes in judgment. But they also think that part of what's going on here is an artificial atmosphere of crisis that has been generated by a couple of factors that are unique to the United States. One is a very aggressive American press that they think in some ways is anti-Catholic. Another is a very well-organized sort of left wing of the American Catholic Church that the Vatican would perceive as taking advantage of this crisis to grind its particular axis, whether it has to do with clerical celibacy or the ordination of women or whatever. And they also see a certain financial hustle at stake. That is, they see, we now have a legal subspecialty having to do with clerical sexual abuse, and it's because that the Catholic Church has some deep pockets that these kind of accusations can tap. When the Vatican looks in on the American situation, what they see, as I say, is one part a genuine pastoral emergency, one part a atmosphere of hysteria that they think has been fed by some factors they're very hesitant to capitulate to. And I think what that means is that to date their reactions have been pretty half-hearted, pretty mixed, pretty defensive. I think that can come across sometimes as contempt, but I don't think that's the best way of reading it. I think it's more, on the one hand, they're reacting as pastors who are concerned for people who are hurting. On the other hand, they're reacting as CEOs who are worried about their institution that they see as under siege.
What's going to happen to Cardinal Bernard Law? A number of cardinals have been pushing for his resignation, as I understand. He made a statement in Rome today. What do you see as the outcome of his personal situation?
I certainly don't think that at the end of this two-day session we're going to have a resignation from Cardinal Law. For one thing, because you know he has said clearly to his people in Boston that he intends to stay on, and I certainly don't think he would have made that kind of statement if he had not cleared his signals from Rome. And you know there, and if you look at his situation from the Vatican's point of view, I haven't met anyone in the Vatican who would defend what Law did in either the Gagan case or the Shanley case. I mean, they would certainly acknowledge there have been serious mistakes in judgment, but they would put that in the context of what they see as several decades of loyal service. Also, there's a realpolitik point here, which is the Vatican is worried about a domino effect. I mean, if Cardinal Law were to resign, then you know those other men who are now bishops, who were his aides, whose signatures are on many of the same documents as Cardinal Law's, by strict logic, they should have to resign too, and then attention would shift pretty quickly to Cardinal Egan, who has many of the same problems. You know, before very long, you could have a fairly large chunk of the American episcopacy wiped out, and certainly from the Vatican's point of view, that's not a good place to be. So, I think that at the moment, the sense still is that the Law can weather the storm. The Vatican would certainly like to see him weather the storm. I don't anticipate any action against him immediately. Whether in the end it's going to prove possible for him to govern this archdiocese, whether he can continue, I think remains to be seen.
Now, until recently, the Vatican has seen this abuse scandal, as you said, sort of as an American problem. You've talked about our litigious society, our investigative journalism being very different. And I think the Vatican long saw it not only as an American problem, but an Anglo problem. But we now have incidents in France. There were 30 people accused since 1995. Uh-huh. We have incidents in Austria and Poland and Nigeria and Germany, in other places. Do you think that this is no longer going to be such an Anglo problem, or simply that now there's going to be more reporting of it elsewhere as there was in America?
Yeah, I think, to be fair, I don't know many people in the Vatican that think sexual abuse is an American problem, precisely because of the examples that you mentioned. I mean, my newspaper broke a story that, which I was one of the, I had shared the byline in this story, about the sexual abuse of women religious, that is nuns, in Africa and elsewhere by priests a year or so ago. This is a problem the Vatican has acknowledged, and that it's a congregation for religious in cooperation with men's and women's religious communities has been working on ever since. What the Vatican sees as an American, or perhaps, as you say, more accurately, an Anglo-Saxon problem, is the very aggressive media response, which they see as, to some extent, exaggerated and fed along by things like the culture of the scoop and scandal in the American press, by a resentment of the very strong positions that the Catholic Church has taken on issues like abortion and birth control and so forth, and by by Anglo-Saxon tort law, which makes it easy to hold the Church corporately liable for the misconduct of its priests. That's, I think, what they diagnose as an Anglo-Saxon problem. But, are we rapidly moving into a situation in which the public discussion and the push for accountability is spilling over the borders of the Anglo-Saxon world into the rest of the world? I think no question. I mean, if you look at the reaction to the case of Archbishop Julius Petz in Poland, this is an archbishop who recently resigned under the weight of accusations of sexual misconduct, which it's important for us to say that he continues to deny them. But nevertheless, he resigned. This really shattered a taboo in Polish society, and I think produced a real sea change. And I think it's entirely realistic to expect that now you will have other cases like that one discussed in Poland. And I think the same thing will be happening other places. So, in a way, I think what you're getting in Anglo-Saxon and especially American culture today is a preview of the kinds of stories the rest of the Catholic world will be grappling with in the years to come.
My guest is John Allen. He is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He's currently in Rome covering the meeting between Pope John Paul II and the American cardinals. We'll talk more with John Allen after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is John Allen. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book, soon to be released, is called Conclave: The Politics, Personalities, and Process of the Next Papal Elections. You've been touring the country and speaking to Catholics in different parts of the United States. What did you hear?
Well, I think the most important observation I can offer you is this, that I really think that this story has shifted on the ground in the American Catholic Church over the last few weeks. I think this started out as a sexual abuse story. I think it has become an accountability story. And what I mean is that certainly American Catholics are outraged by the revelations that we have seen about the Gagan case in Boston, the abuse of children, the Shanley case also in Boston. Those sorts of things are indefensible, and they would horrify anyone who cares to read the case files. But I also think Catholics are realistic enough to recognize that priests being people, some priests, like some people, are going to do abominable things. I think what really has Catholics outraged at the moment is the broader question of the way their bishops have responded to that misconduct. I mean, it's the moving abuser priest from assignment to assignment. It's paying hush money in the form of to settle civil litigation. It's the use of retaliatory litigation to intimidate victims from coming forward. It's all of that that Catholics have drawn the conclusion that their managers, their leaders, have failed them. Not all, but certainly a number. And that has a lot of Catholics asking some very basic questions about to whom are their leaders accountable? And is it enough for bishops to be accountable only to Rome? Or isn't it also important that they be accountable to the local churches that they serve? Which in turn generates other questions, like how do you get bishops in the first place, and why don't local churches play a greater role in picking them? And why can't lay people play a much more profound role in making decisions about finance and governance and personnel? All of these things that don't touch upon doctrine, but touch upon how the church is run. And so I think that's the sea change that's going on in the American Catholic Church at the moment, and I think that conversation is only beginning.
So you're saying that people want democratization, more lay power, and in some sense that's a more possible avenue of change than asking for a change of doctrine.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would use the word democratization, because that's a word that is a very explosive word, because the Vatican will always say the church is not a democracy. American bishops will say the church is not a democracy. And of course it's true. I mean, nobody is talking about getting together in a room in voting on a 50% plus one basis, whether we believe in the resurrection anymore. I mean, that's a model that doesn't make sense for the Catholic Church. But I do think, probably the better word for it is accountability and perhaps also lay empowerment. I mean, how do you bring laity into a situation so that bishops are accountable to them? And you're right. That's, in a way, it's an easier thing to fix than some of the other questions that people have connected to this sex abuse crisis. I mean, for example, some commentators in the American press have suggested that if the Catholic Church were to ordain women, you would have a more sort of balanced, base of clergy, a larger pool of people from whom to draw, and it would make it easier to screen out potential abusers. You know, that very well may be true, but there is a real theological obstacle to the ordination of women. I mean, this pontificate, that is the John Paul II, has published documents that insist that the ban on women's ordination is all but infallible, meaning unreformable. So you have to jump through some very serious doctrinal hoops before you can get to a place where you can talk about women's ordination. On the other hand, bringing laity back into the governance of the church really does nothing more than take the church back to its roots. I mean, in the early centuries of the church and really on into very recent times. The first bishop of the United States, for example, John Carroll, was elected by the clergy of his diocese and of the United States, and that choice was simply ratified in Rome as late as 1829, when Pope Leo XII died. There were 646 Catholic bishops outside the Papal States, which is the region of Italy the Pope ruled as a secular monarch. Of those 646, only 24 had been appointed directly by the Pope. The rest had all been picked either by a secular government or by the people of the local community. So there is no doctrinal obstacle to raising this question of who are bishops accountable to. And so in a way, it's an easier problem to fix.
In America, there's a lot of talk about the Catholic Church and the culture of celibacy and that as a problem. That the whole question of the Church's teaching on sexuality is at issue here. Is it?
Well, I mean, from a certain point of view, of course it is. I mean, you know, sexuality is, one of the most central, if not the most central aspect of human existence, and I suppose the Church is always going to be working on getting its teaching exactly right. And I think one of the fascinating things, just in terms of the politics of this, is that on the sexual questions, my experience in talking to Catholics these days is that they is the same divisions that existed before this present crisis still exist. That is to say, the sort of liberal wing of the American Catholic Church still would like to make celibacy optional, would like to reopen the question of gay rights, for example, would push for a revision of the teaching on birth control. And conservatives would tend to take opposite positions on all of those questions. In other words, those continue to be divisive issues, and this crisis, if anything, has simply strengthened people in their pre-existing convictions. On the other hand, on the governance question, on the accountability question, what I find is this is now an issue that is uniting people from left, right, and center. And so where it used to be sort of conservative clergy and conservative Catholics versus liberal clergy and liberal Catholics on sexual issues, I think a new fault line that we have today is between laity of all ideological stripes demanding much greater roles in governance from their clerical leaders. And so in that sense, I think the crisis is really reconfiguring the politics of the American Catholic Church in a very fascinating way.
John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His new book, to be released in June, is called Conclave: The Politics, Personalities, and Process of the Next Papal Election. We'll talk more with John Allen in the second half of the show. I'm Margo Adler. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Justice Hall, a novel of suspense by Laurie R. King, author of The Beekeeper's Apprentice, available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with journalist John Allen about the meeting in Rome between American cardinals and Vatican officials. Also, we talk with French film director Laurent Conté about his critically acclaimed new movie, Time Out. This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's return to our discussion with John Allen. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He's in Rome covering the meeting between the Pope and the American Catholic Cardinals. He's also the author of a soon-to-be-released book, Conclave: the politics, personalities, and process of the next papal election. We spoke to him earlier today.
Various states, John, are passing laws, various states in the United States, that force the church to report sex abusers.
Right.
Rhode Island passed a law that says a priest has to report what he hears in the confessional. I found myself, perhaps because I'm 56 years old, I found myself shocked by that. I still tend to think about priests and therapists as people who have, the power of total confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
Are we witnessing a change that's going to make the trust of the confessional a thing of the past?
No, I don't think so. I think certainly the leadership of the church will fight that sort of thing, to the last drop of energy that they've got. And I think the sort of case law is fairly solidly on the church's side. So I don't see the seal of the confessional being in play here. On the other hand, the broader question of whether or not bishops ought to be what's called an automatic reporter, that is, that they ought to, as a matter of policy, be obliged to report to the police any credible evidence of criminal misconduct against a priest that comes to them outside the seal of confessional. I think that question is very much an unsettled one. There's an enormous clamor for it in the American press. On the other hand, the Vatican has very serious reservations, or at least over the years has had very serious reservations. For a couple of reasons. One is that they like to think of the relationship between a bishop and his priest as sort of a father and son. And the notion is that if a priest knows that if he confides in a bishop that he's done something wrong, and that bishop is then obligated to call the police, the priest is much less likely to confide in the first place, and therefore that it would compromise this relationship of trust that ought to exist. Also, the Vatican believes that there probably are some victims and their families that would prefer to work these things out, quietly, confidentially, with the church without involving the police. And if you have an automatic reporter policy, then in a way you take that discretion away from the bishop. So I don't see the seal of confessional being in any serious jeopardy. I do see this question of what the bishop should be obligated to report versus what's going to be in his discretion to report. That's very much a live issue, and I don't think we know yet how it's going to be resolved.
More broadly, do you see a conflict between just the whole notion of forgiveness of sins and accountability?
Yeah, this is a tough one, and I think you saw this in the Pope's address today. I mean, the Pope said, we need to have tough policies, and we need to be sure that, that someone who has been an abuser is never put in a position where they can abuse again. But on the other hand, really in the same paragraph, he said, we can't lose sight of the notion of Christian conversion, of repentance. This is the problem. Zero tolerance policies are not a good fit for a church that has, the sacramental understanding of sin and redemption, the notion that no matter what you've done, no matter how awful it is, you can make a fresh start. I mean, you can be contrite, you can ask for forgiveness, and having received it, then you can begin again. And I think the church is still struggling with that. What is happening at the moment is that it is learning to separate, the sort of spiritual question of someone's capacity for conversion from the policy question of what do you do with them when they have committed a serious offense. And I think that distinction, unpacking that idea, is taking some time. The other bit of just, ecclesiastical psychology, I think, that's relevant here is that in some ways, some of the vices that we're seeing in terms of, moving these abuser priests from assignment to assignment or writing nice letters for them, trying to get them other jobs or backing them up when they're in a tough spot. I mean, these are vices that in some cases are born of an excess of virtue. That is that, you have bishops who really are doing everything they can to try to prop up and support struggling members of the clerical club. So far as it goes, it's a noble intention. The problem is that it's a form of tribal morality. And by that I mean the moral rules, this moral concern applies only to members of the tribe. And once you step outside the clerical world, then the people out there don't count as much. And so, I also think what's going on right now is that leaders of the church, those people who have risen through the ranks of clerical culture, are being forced to redefine, to expand the zone of moral concern to include not just priests, but the whole people of God, and so that the claim the priest has to be supported in his tough moments is now going to have to be balanced against the claim that the people have not to be put in a position where they could be abused by this guy. And so I think there is a learning process that's going on that, to be fair, has begun and in some places has taken root more profoundly than others. But certainly that process is going to have to be accelerated as part of the resolution to this crisis.
You tell a story about Pope John the 23rd that after a difficult day, he said, I'm only the Pope. I'm going to bed. And then you speak of John Paul II in a very different way, as almost messianic in his own belief about his own actions.
Yeah, well, I mean, this pope has a very strong sense of election. You know, usually this comes up in the context. Another question people often ask is this pope going to resign? And although canon law makes a provision for it, canon 332.2 has a provision for a pope to resign. I think it's almost incredible that John Paul II is going to exercise it. One, because he said he's not going to. I mean, in 1994, when he had his hip replacement surgery, he told the doctor that you have to heal me and I have to get better because there's no room in the church for an emeritus pope. And again in 95, on the anniversary of his ordination to the priesthood, he said, it's in the hands of God how much longer I continue. But even at a sort of deeper psychological level than that, it's clear this pope believes that he has been put in this position by divine providence, and he's been kept there by divine providence. And the classic case in point is he believes that on May 13th, 1981, when Mehmet Ali Aka shot him in St. Peter's Square, that the Virgin Mary actually altered the flight path of a bullet to keep him in office. You know, if that bullet had gone 6 inches in either direction, it would have punctured a heart or punctured a lung, and he would have been dead. And May 13th happens to be the feast day of Our Lady of Fatima. And on the one-year anniversary of the assassination attempt, the Pope went to Fatima and placed the bullet in the crown of the Virgin of Fatima as a way of thanking her for keeping him in office. So, you know, I think if you believe that that the Virgin Mary and the divine realm is suspending the laws of physics in order to keep you in office, I just don't think you wake up one morning and decide, I'm finished. I mean, this is enough. I'll hit the lecture circuit or something like that. It's just not psychologically consistent.
Thank you, John, very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. His column is called The Word from Rome. We spoke to him earlier today. Coming up, French film director Laurent Conté speaks about his new film, Time Out. This is Fresh Air. There are very few movies about the world of work, but French film director Laurent Conté has explored this realm in two films. His first, Human Resources, which came out in 1999, explores the world of factory work. A young man gets a job in management in a factory where he has to lay off workers, including his own father. In his latest film, Time Out, Conté explores the world of global corporate management. It's the story of a man who loses his job but continues to keep his same schedule, faking a job with the United Nations in Switzerland and lying about it to friends and family. When I began my conversation with Laurent Conté, I said that if an alien came down from another planet and was to learn about our world only from movies, the alien would think that work was only a scanty portion of our lives, not half our waking day.
Work takes a lot of time, and also most of us are defined by our job, and we don't exist if we don't have a job. You don't ask someone in the street, who are you? You just ask him, what are you doing? And it's very difficult to exist and to have a place in the society if you are unemployed, if you don't want to work, if you just consider you as a man who can work sometimes and sometimes just take time to leave and to raise his children, for example.
So, for example, we don't say to someone when we are asked, well, I work at McDonald's, but I'm really a poet.
Yes.
You know, even though that may be true.
Right.
In Time Out, you see sort of the global corporate world of agencies, organizations, bureaucracies. It's a world behind glass doors and business parks. And you hear a language that one almost never hears in movies, what I might call it global speak or corporate jargon. Tell me about that language and how you used it.
So when I work with actors, most of them are non-professional. And most of them are people who are working in the same kind of work that they are playing in the film. So they bring with them their language, their words, the way to say things. And I don't write it by myself. I just give ideas of what I want them to say and then ask them to use the real vocabulary of the people that they are playing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what helped me a lot.
So you got your the people in, for example, human resources who were not actors, you got some of them from unemployment lines, correct?
Yes, and also in Time Out.
And in Time Out, you also got some from what we might call a white-collar, upper-middle-class suburb of Paris.
Yes, and so most of them were looking for a new job when I met them. And they were happy to just discover what the film is and how it's made. So, you know, we work a very long time together before shooting. And it helps me to write the script. It helps me to understand who they are, and I'm always trying to use in the film what the actors can bring to me. You know, when you work with a professional actor, it's quite difficult to have it with you during 5 or 6 months before shooting. And I need this kind of rehearsal session and this improvisation session that we do before shooting just to help me to write the dialogues that would fit them. And it also, I think, permits to give a certain sound to the film.
Perhaps the man who I found to have the most character in Time Out is Serge Livrezé. He plays a petty smuggler who sells knockoff designer goods. When I look at him in the film, he seemed both wise in human affairs and the ways of the street. How did you find him, and what's his story?
Sorry, it's quite a long story. In fact, he was a burglar.
He was a burglar?
Yes, but it was 30 years ago, and he spent 10 years in prison. And in prison, he started to read a lot of books and to write a lot of books too. And he became militant, an anarchist militant. And when he came out of prison, he met Michel Foucault and Jean-Paul Sartre, for example, who were just starting the new Libération newspaper. And he worked with them, and so he has this past of burglar, but in the same times he had the distance to it too, and it was very interesting for me to work with him because he could just speak like someone of this milieu, and his life in the same times is really connected to the subject of the film. When he was 14, he was supposed to learn a job. He was going to be a plumber, and he realized that he wouldn't stand it, And he says in one of his books that these days I realized that I was condemned to perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to escape.
That's how he came, that's why he became an anarchist?
Yes. And that's why he became, right, he had no, he was not intellectual at all. And then he decided just to stop his work. And the only way he found to exist was to go in the south of France, and he became burglars.
Now, in the film, there's a wonderful scene in which Livre-Rosé takes out a scrapbook of his crimes and shows it to Vincent, the protagonist. And there are pictures of him in prison. And someone told me that those are actual photos of him and his real life.
Yes, the photos are real. We just wrote the new text, but the photos are the real one. You can see him in the tribunal, how do you say that?
In court and in the
in
trial.
Court, and yes. And right, he gave us the real pictures of his trial.
Huh. The title of Time Out in French is L'emploi du temps. It doesn't mean what we think of it in the English sense. In the English sense, it means taking a break, but it means schedule, doesn't it?
It means two things, in fact. It's schedule, and also, if you go back to the meaning, the literal meaning of it, it's the way you use your time.
Mm-hmm. So,
and
yes,
it was interesting for me to use these two meanings, because it speaks of the schedule of a professional schedule and the way it takes all your life, and also it shows a man who is trying to use his time exactly the way he would like to use it.
So in the first scene of the film, we see Vincent in his car. We see him very happy. We see him racing a train like a little mm-hmm. kid. He's singing. And we learn that he's happiest when he's driving, and that, in fact, he lost his job not because he was openly incompetent or anything, but he just lost his focus because he would drive around and miss meetings, you know?
For me, he even decided to lose his job. He's responsible of it. He is not a victim of unemployment, I think. He just decided once that it was too boring to go on working like that. And he just decided to accept to be fired.
But then why does he insist on keeping the same schedule? I mean, we see a man who essentially keeps the same schedule even though he's fired. He goes to right. the UN agency, we should say, and he wanders in Switzerland. He walks around. He pretends to be a worker. He fits in. He wears a suit, a tie. He has a briefcase. He has a cell phone. He passes most of the time. I mean, there are guards that stop him and so forth, but who tell him to move on. But most of the time he passes, and he has all that equipment, you know, the cell phone, mm-hmm. the tie, the suit, etc.
I think there are two reasons for that. First, he likes the image people have from him. And he is even going higher in the hierarchy by inventing this job in UN. So he likes his life as he has a bourgeois life, and he likes it. He doesn't want to change all his life. The only thing he wants is to get free of all the constraints of work. And the new constraints you are speaking of are maybe not exactly the same, because he can invent them. He creates his story. He's writing his story every day and every hours, and he has to play it too. And we always imagined him like a script writer who can be excited by lying. And I think everybody who is listening to who is looking at the film can recognize himself in this. I think everybody lied once in his life and found
at least
it, at least yes. And it's obviously exciting to build a good lie. That can be a sort of creation.
And then, of course, once you build one, you have to build more.
You have to go on, and that's what he didn't maybe realize at the beginning of the story, that life is always more complicated than a script. And when you are starting with a lie, you have to go on, because a lot of people has to be involved in your lie, and then you have to be sure that what you said to one is corresponding to what you said to the other one, and it can become very you can become very busy with that.
I'm talking with Laurent Conté about his new film Time Out, playing in movie theaters now. His previous film, Human Resources, is also about the workplace. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Laurent Conté, director of the new French film Time Out. In the film, Vincent, the protagonist, has lost his job, and he takes up with a small-time smuggler of imported designer knockoffs. In some sense, when you look at the smuggler that he works for a while, when you look at Liv Rosé and he is showing him the designer goods, there's a moment when you almost think that those goods, those smuggled designer ripoffs, are in some sense more than the language that you hear in the UN agency.
Yes, that was what we decided to why we decided to make of Jean-Michel this kind of
to make him this kind of character.
This kind of character, because I thought funny and interesting that the reality can be brought back to Vincent through fakes.
And in fact,
can you understand?
Yes, I understand that. Yes, in other words, the fake things that this man is smuggling in and producing are much more real than anything in the film. And in fact, when
because you know you have these box to carry, you have those things to you have to go across the country just to bring back things, and you right, it exists, and if you have money, in the end, you know why, you know that it's just because someone bought you those glasses and those boxes you brought back, so that's suddenly something that can be right.
It's real. Tangible. It's tangible.
Tangible.
It's real.
Right. Yes.
From making these two films about work, do you sense that you now know some things about work that you didn't know when you began? About the way work works and the way we live. Have you your own views changed and grown as you have done this film?
Well, I know now that a lot of people are working like slaves, are considering work like slavery. But I thought a lot of more people could find
You thought more people were satisfied before
Yes. I thought more people were satisfied by the job. And in fact, I realized that a lot of people can understand what my film says. And a lot of people feel a victim of their work, of their schedule, of this social play, this social role you have to play.
Yes. I once did a radio show, a live radio show, where I took phone calls way into the night. And one of the things I noticed is that if you ever approach the subject of people's work and the meaninglessness of most of it, the floodgates open. People will talk about feeling underemployed, of not doing jobs that engage their passions. They will talk all night about it. They will talk about their fantasies, what they want to do. And I've always thought that was particularly American, but maybe not.
It's not. Unfortunately, it's not. You know, with my two films, I did a lot of Q&As in theaters in France and all over the world. And those Q&As usually takes, right, half an hour. And with those two films, I was speaking during 1 hour and a half, 2 hours, and people wanted to go on speaking, and not speaking of the film, but speaking of themselves, and speaking of the way they recognize themselves, their life in the films. And I think that's the reason why they like the film.
Mm-hmm. Your own work, though, your own work as a filmmaker, I would imagine, is an example of somewhat unalienated work.
Yes, I think that's maybe the reason why I'm a filmmaker. I don't think I would be able to work like Vincent, for example. And my way to escape from that was perhaps to try to make film, and I manage it, so I'm happy now.
Thank you so much, Laurent Conté, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Laurent Conté is the director of the new French film, Time Out. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Margot Adler.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and also sponsored in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, the new album by Wilco, available at Barnes & Noble Music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why climates are stable and why they change, we talk with Paul Majewski, co-author of The Ice Chronicles, The Quest to Understand Global Climate Change. I'm Margot Adler. Join us for the next Fresh Air.